So I just kind of want to take a poll here. How many people here are affiliated with UM in some manner? All right, how many are grad students? Okay. How many do mechanical engineering? How many know what I'm going to talk about right now? Yeah, okay, all right. Great. So, to get started, I just want to tell you that I'm also a graduate student. And I do acoustics. And so one of the hardest things about working in a STEM field is developing an intuition for the field. And it's really hard because when you're first starting out, you basically just have to go back to really hardcore equations every time you have a question and work them out. And it's really, really painful. Once you develop intuition, you don't have to do that anymore. You just kind of have a gut feeling for what's going to happen. But with acoustics, we all have that gut feeling already. We use it all the time. We were born with sound. It's awesome for that reason. So that's why, so what I want to tell you about is something really awesome with acoustics that you don't have the intuition for. And we'll talk about more. But basically, sound can travel really, really far. I'm going to give you two different examples of cases where that happens. Hopefully a third if we got time, but probably just two. So let's get started. So to start things off, I'm going to start off with a story. So anyone here a fan of history? History? Oh, all right. History fans. All right, so Civil War. So as you might recall, North versus South, right? Federalists versus the Confederates. So I specifically want to talk about the Battle of Gettysburg, which, if those of you don't recall, it's about 2 years into the Civil War, and the South is not doing so great. They really just not doing great, and so they went into the game plan was to go into the North and bring the battle there. And by bringing the battle there, they'd hope to alleviate some of the stress going on in the South and hopefully turn the war around. And so the Confederate Army and the Union Army met at Gettysburg. Well, let me start you off here. Map of Gettysburg, and lots of different altitude things going on, and roads and rivers and stuff, but I'm going to just erase those. The main event is a big hill right in the middle of Gettysburg. And after day one, the Union got there first and secured their position along the hill, which is unfortunate because that's about a 150-foot hill, which tough to really put that into numbers, but you know the Arboretum, that sort of altitude difference there is at the top and towards the bottom. That's about 150 foot also. So, you know, when you've got cannons and mortars and things like that, it's strategically advantageous to be up there, right? And so when the Confederates are down near the bottom, they're really taking a beating in the main attack. And so they realize they have no shot of winning this war unless they are somehow able to get the Unions off the hill. And so General Lee sends some troops around the side to sort of do a sneak attack. But the problem is that the Union would, upon seeing a sneak attack, send troops from over here down to defend, right? Well, that's bad news because there's too many Union people and they would block the sneak attack, right? So you got the Confederates have to come up with some way to stop that from happening. So what they do is they put some more troops over here and they're gonna do a little diversion. They're just gonna pretend to fight and occupy the troops over here, thus preventing them from going over and helping these guys out. And the game plan was sneak attack, breaks down this side, main attack falls through, and then the diversion turns into a real attack, and the Confederates win. But it requires really careful timing, right? Because the sneak attack, if it starts too soon, then the diversion didn't happen yet, and they would just go and defend them, right? So we need timing. And so the game plan was the sneak attack would start, and you could hear that because it's really loud, you know, cannons and such. And the diversion would hear that, and they would start also. And so they launched a sneak attack. Diversion guys heard nothing. No sound at all. So no diversion happened, and basically worst case scenario happened. Confederates performed terribly at this round. On day three, they led Pickett's Charge, which is one of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War, which is one of the bloodiest battles of all modern times. So, you know, not a good day for the Confederates. So anyway, this is about 3 miles apart. So it's kind of surprising that they didn't hear anything because, I mean, we don't really experience cannon fire every day to know how far you hear that, but suffice it to say, 3 miles, you should be able to hear that. So now, a little interesting twist to the story. If we go to a bigger map here, Gettysburg, so just Google Earth here. Gettysburg, there's a small town down here called Taneytown. and about 12 miles away, and they didn't hear anything there either. So also not surprising, right? You didn't hear anything 3 miles, why would you hear it 12 miles away? Continuing to zoom out, got Gettysburg, Taneytown, 150 miles away in Pittsburgh. They actually heard it. So they heard it, and that's so strange, right? Why would you hear it farther away and not close? So to explain that, we gotta go back to fundamental physics. What is sound? Here's the question we have to ask ourselves. Excuse me, sorry. Coughed in the wrong thing. Anyway, so what is sound? And there's usually two good answers here, vibrations and waves. So vibrations, if you want to test that out, try putting your hand on your throat when you talk. So everyone do it, you know, hum or something, talk. Feel it? Feel it? Vibration, sound. Waves, on the other hand, is what I want to talk about. And I got a nice little demo for that. So, TJ, if you wouldn't mind. Yeah, demo, woo! Each of these rungs is supposed to represent air molecules, or basically any molecule capable of producing sound, which is basically all of them. So, the idea here is that your vocal cords make a sound, which basically means, sorry about that, they vibrate and they push air molecules right in front of them. So, polarotype, and basically, wave travels like that. Anyone see that? I don't know. So, sound wave. Air molecules bump into one another, which bump into the next one, bump into the next one, and photo op. Anyway, so that's sound. Okay, so we can do more than one dimension. We can go to two or three dimensions. So, each of these little black dots is supposed to be an air molecule, and really they're supposed to be whizzing around at like 1,000 miles an hour, but PowerPoint was not having that. So, stationary it is. When you push onto them, they do this, which is just the wave that you just saw on the Slinky, just wider, right? So, as you can see, the wave is clearly traveling to the right, but this happens only when everything's the same temperature, because sound speed, how quickly this wave travels, is a function of temperature. Now, when you have different temperatures, such as cold and hot, that translates into slow and fast, respectively. And so, when you have a wave go across this, we're gonna expect it to travel slowly across here and quickly across here, right? Let's watch that happen. Curves, right? Curves upward, and specifically towards a slow medium. So if you take away nothing else about these little demos and stuff here, sound bends towards a slower medium. That's what we care about. And so how does this all relate to Gettysburg, right? So, well, that's supposed to be green, but it's purple now, it's grass. So we've got the ground, and what I want to do is I want to talk about temperature. So it was really hot, got cut off a little bit, but really hot at Gettysburg, middle of July, 95 degrees, probably an appropriate temperature there. So now 10 miles up, which is already above where planes and clouds are at, 10 miles up, it's really cold, minus 70. You know, winters in Michigan really suck, but not that bad. That's extra cold. But now the really interesting part here is that at 30 miles, you'd expect it to just be extra cold, but it's not. It actually warms back up to a balmy 30. And the reason for that is ozone. So ultraviolet light comes in from the sun, hits these ozone molecules, which absorb the energy, turn it into heat, so it warms back up. So from a sound speed point of view, what we've got is hot, cold, hot, or equivalently, fast, slow, fast. So with that in mind, again, keep in mind, sound bends towards the slower medium. When we stick Gettysburg down here in the war, we have the sound coming off of there. So now the sound is going to... Sound goes off sideways, but it bends, and it bends upward. It bends upward pretty drastically. And it keeps going, but now it's in the cold region, going towards hot. So it's gonna start bending back down again towards the cold, like that. It's gonna go so far that it actually turns back around. And finally, now it's heading back down again towards the hot, gonna continue to bend towards the cold. Like that. So, end result here, no one hears anything at Taneytown. The general in charge of the diversion doesn't hear anything. And they hear things in Pittsburgh. Mystery solved. But they didn't know this during the Civil War. In fact, it took until about the early 1900s for some brilliant guy, Dr. Maurice Ewing, to come up with this. But he didn't come up with it first in the atmosphere. He came up with it first in the ocean. So that's what I want to talk about, because as far as sound's concerned, it doesn't matter if it's air molecules or water molecules. The end result is everything has sound, right? Because all you need is for it to bump into one another. So in the ocean, we have a very similar situation. So let me give you a little cartoon here for the ocean. The ocean's really deep, 3 miles deep. Which is, I mean, vertically, that would be like where parachuters jump out at, going to the ground, it's 3 miles. Very, very deep. That's just the average. In the range, we can go up to, you know, thousands of miles. Oceans are big. So near the top, the sun warms that, making it warm. In the middle layers, it's cold, and about a half mile down, so it's so dark that photosynthesis can't even take place. So very, very dark. And then it continues down, and it remains cold, but then we have another influence of pressure, and at really, really high pressure, the sound speed starts to change also. And so the combination of these guys wind up with fast, slow, fast, something we've seen before, right? So if I were to stick a source here, so that could be a whale, a submarine, me clapping my hands, you know, whatever. we stick a source there, some of the sound is going to go straight up, and it's going to hit the surface, and it's going to bounce off. And the surface is really rough because of all the waves, and so that'll just dissipate very quickly. Some of it will hit the bottom, and the bottom is also very muddy and doesn't really... bad news for sound, basically, so it won't go very far there. But some of it will travel sideways, and because of the fast, slow, fast thing, what we're going to see is the same loopy patterns going on. So sound actually gets trapped in these layers, and it never touches the top or the bottom. That's really cool, because I mean sound can travel really, really far distances, much farther than you'd ever expect it to in the ocean. So how far does it travel? Well, in order to figure that out, you'd need a big ocean, right? Well, conveniently, we've got one of those. So if you're a scientist, where are you going to put it? Where are you going to test your experiment out?
The red dot.
The red dot to the guy who's seen it before. There's a tiny little red dot down here in the middle of nowhere. Really middle of nowhere. It's about 2,000 miles to the closest airstrip. 2,000 miles. Like, nowhere. It's called Heard Island. Tiny little island. It's got a very convenient point, this is. Some very smart guys figured this one out. They found that if you draw straight lines coming out of here, they actually can touch both coasts of the U.S., So I said straight lines, but naturally it just looks like I curved them around conveniently where I wanted them to go, right? But I didn't. I'm not bullshitting you. So we got Heard Island over here, right? So this is Google Earth, taking into account all the curvature of the Earth. Traveling sideways, just barely past the tip of Africa, across West Africa, hits Nova Scotia. Similar deal down here, grazes Brazil, hits Bermuda. Also, hard to see, Heard Island, can thread the needle between Australia and New Zealand, hit Seattle, or graze Antarctica around New Zealand, hit San Francisco. So these are straight lines, these are legitimately straight lines. So you'd expect that if you stuck a source right at Heard Island, that you'd hope to hear the sound at Nova Scotia, Bermuda, Seattle, and San Francisco. So that was the game plan. Problem is, Heard Island, like I said, is really hard to get to. Can't really fly a plane because there's no landing strip on an uninhabited island like this. By the way, I checked the weather at this place today, 35 degrees and 5 to 7 inches of snow. So, average Michigan. Maybe a little warm for us. Anyway, so, not a very fun place to hang out. It takes 2.5 weeks to get here by boat. And a giant boat at that, 265 feet or something and 4,000 horsepower. Big, big boat. And so they drop these giant speakers in. Giant. And they're hoping to hear them really far away. So they plop the speakers down. And any bets on what happened? Yeah, you're right. They heard it. Yep. It actually worked. And I think this is just the coolest. Sound legitimately traveled halfway around the world. And it did it both ways, so I'm going to count that all the way around the world. I think this is just absolutely phenomenal. So it took the sound 3.5 hours to travel all the way over here. 3.5 hours. That's, you know, make a wiggle in the ocean, wait 3.5 hours. That thing's still traveling, until eventually it gets there. I don't know. I think it's just the absolute coolest, and hence I want to share it with you guys. So yeah, and hence the title of my talk, The Sound Heard Around the World. But I'm not done. I'm not done yet. Because I want to tell you how awful Heard Island is. So this was supposed to be a 10-day experiment. They made it to the fifth day before they encountered 30-foot seas and 7-mile-an-hour winds, which 30-foot, I don't really have a concept for how big that is, especially considering how big the boat is, but a roughly equivalently-sized boat, that's hard to run a precision experiment on, or just be on in general. And so they had this really amusing graph. It got cut off a little bit there, but a sources gram is what they called it. And this is a plot of the number of working sources versus day of the experiment. General downward trend here. Start off with 10 good ones. First day, they lose 4. And they try and repair some, but the general trend is down. In fact, there's one that just broke off from the ship entirely and continues to lay at the bottom of the Indian Ocean. Now, the extra amusing part for me is that they bother to calculate the half-life of these sources, which is 1.2 days. So these would probably be classified as radioactive sources, I guess. Anyway, so yeah, Heard Island. So Roswell, does that mean anything to you guys? Aliens? Okay, all right. So the reason for Roswell is actually related to everything I just talked about. So we got to go back to the Cold War. This is during a time when Russia's got Stalin in charge. And when the U.S. wants to know what's going on in Russia, you can't really just ask. Nor can they really send spies, because Stalin will just kill them. So they're really just in the dark about what Russia's doing, specifically with respect to the nuclear bomb. So they went all out of their way so that Dr. Maurice Ewing, after finding this in the ocean, found it in the atmosphere. And he found that if you got a microphone up high enough in the atmosphere, that if an atomic bomb went off in Russia, it would do that curvy thing all the way over to the U.S. And they'd be able to hear it. And if you have enough balloons around, you can figure out where it took place, how loud it was, and therefore how powerful the atomic bomb was. So pretty important stuff. So also super-duper classified. So this was like way, way under wraps. And so they went through a lot of time designing balloons that are strong enough and light enough to be able to carry a payload such as a bunch of microphones way up into the atmosphere, you know, 10, 20 miles up into the atmosphere, way up there. And so there's some trial and error expected with those balloons. One of the balloons, which was tested in New Mexico, crash-landed at Roswell Air Force Base. And so because it was such a need-to-know project, the guys at the Air Force Base had no idea what just crash-landed on their property. But they were quick to get rid of it, and some poor sucker decided to tell the media that, yeah, a flying disc landed. And was confiscated by the Air Force, to which he was promptly fired. And then the next day, they said, no flying disc. I don't know what you're talking about. That was a weather balloon or something. Which, of course, you know, the UFO guys were like, what, that, aliens, guys, aliens. But eventually, the people with the right clearances came by and told them, no, what they just landed there was some balloons meant to spy on Russia, but we can't possibly admit to that because that would start World War III. So, basically, yeah. Roswell incident, just balloons. Specifically related to acoustics. So that's pretty fun. Fun fact with these balloons, they launched a ton of them. And because it was really, really windy up there, the balloons just landed, or didn't land, they just drifted everywhere. But some of them just popped or got shot down or anything. Some of them landed in Russia, about like 25 of them landed in Russia, and they put them in a museum. So yeah, anyway. I don't think so, but they had these radar reflectors on them that basically told them, like, at least someone's transmitting information with this. So I don't know, you know, I'm not really up to date on my Soviet-era knowledge and what they knew, but I would speculate that they had an idea that it wasn't supposed to be there. But I don't know if they knew exactly what it was being used for. Anyway, eventually in 1991, I think it was, all the stuff was declassified right around the time the USSR fell. So, not a coincidence. But declassified, now I get to tell fun stories about it. So there's some other uses, if I've got the time. So whales have known about this stuff for a really long time. It wasn't really Maurice Ewing who discovered it. Whales did. They just weren't sharing the information. So anyway, whales use this for mating and stuff to communicate long distances. Also during the Cold War, finding submarines using the, I don't think I ever named it, the SOFAR channel is what it's called in the ocean, SOFAR channel, anyway. They used the SOFAR channel to find where the Russian submarines are at. And Russian submarines at the time were super noisy, so it made it really easy to find them. Also why it's super secret, because if Russians knew that they were really loud and could easily be pinpointed, they probably wouldn't have been doing that. So finding submarines, super useful for search and rescue. This is a fun one. So if a pilot went down in the middle of the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean with no one around to see him, he was basically screwed. There's basically no shot, because if you signal for help, then the enemy would hear your radio transmission and like, oh, look, there's an enemy we missed. Take care of that issue. So the trick was to use these called SOFAR spheres, very cleverly named, and they are basically just hollow metal spheres. And they were told, if they ever crashed, they'd have it in their little pack, probably with water and stuff, to drop it in the ocean. And it would drop, and it would, at a certain depth, implode, which is really, really loud. And that depth, right in the middle of the SOFAR channel. So the sound would travel really, really far, and if you had enough receivers, you could triangulate where it was, and then you could go and send help. And they had a couple of them. And the best part is, if an enemy ever said, like, hey, whoa, whoa, what are those metal balls you're doing? Well, cut them open. They're empty. So extra confusing for an enemy who tries to capture you. So the Heard Island experiment, unfortunately, you can't get funding to just go out and, hey, this will be fun, right, guys? You can't really get funding for that. So instead, you need to do it under the guise of, we're going to measure the temperature of the ocean. Because if you know how long it takes to get from point A to point B, then you know the sound speed, and like I said, it's relevant to the temperature, so you can figure out the temperature of the ocean, which is useful for global warming stuff. Also, Heard Island's just a lot of fun. Not to actually be there, just to talk about it. Also, there are a ton of other Civil War battles in which acoustic shadows happened, which I don't have enough time to talk about, but there's lots of other ones. So I'd like to thank you all very much, and here's a bunch of phrases you can Google.